Welcome to the Influential Women Podcast, the podcast where we talk up close and personal to some incredible female thrivers and survivors, and women who continue to inspire and motivate both Juliet and myself, guests who may just help you to overcome adversity in your own day and maybe change your perspective in your own life. This is Nikki Bannerman, and my influential woman today is Rowan Coleman. Hello and welcome, Rowan.
Hello, Nikki. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure, and lovely to see where you're writing from there in Hertfordshire. Rowan is a successful, award-winning and Sunday Times best-selling author. So, Rowan, you've just launched your 14th book, The Girl at the Window, and the well-known Irish novelist Marion Keyes described you as brilliant, charming and moving as an author she loves. How does that feel?
It felt really amazing. Marion is a writing hero of mine. I think she's absolutely the best. She's the queen at what she does. So when I heard that, I ran around jumping around and yelping.
And so you should be proud of yourself. She's sold about 35 million copies of her novels, hasn't she? So that's a huge accolade. So tell us about your book, The House Full of History and Secrets, The Girl at the Window.
It's sort of a haunting love story. It's set in a real place, Pondon Hall, which is just outside of Haworth in West Yorkshire. It's a house that I absolutely fell in love with the first time I visited it. And the more I found out about it, the more interesting I thought it would be. So it's it weaves together three storylines. There's a contemporary storyline about a woman called Trudy Heaton, who returns back home to Pondon Hall after the loss of her husband with her little boy, Will. And then there is a 19th century storyline featuring my other hero, Emily Bronte. And then there is a 17th century storyline, which is based on the true history of Pondon Hall. And all three are drawn together in a sort of woven into a tapestry of three timelines that weave into one whole story at the end, and each timeline means something to the other.
Wow, that's incredibly complex. Yes, how do you construct something?
Do you have a massive wall planner or?
I have a massive wall planner. I'll give you a quick glint.
Oh, I say, gosh. Oh, wow. So there's post-it notes all over the wall everywhere. Fantastic.
Post-its, yeah. I'm a post-it note person.
And then you move them around with your themes and your threads and then make sense of it in that way before you structure it.
Yes, colour code. So for The Girl at the Window, I colour code it by thread. Sometimes I colour code it by author.
Author,
character.
And do you start at the end or you start at the beginning?
I always know what the ending is. I start at the beginning to work towards the ending. And sort of see where we go from there. There's always a muddy bit in the middle, but it takes me usually about 5 goes to get it right.
Wow. And you know, you say it's your 14th novel in your own name, but you've had a lot more than that, haven't you, that you've written?
Yes, I think I've written about, I've definitely written more than 30 novels. I've lost count, if I'm honest. I've written for children under my own name, and I've written horror for teens under the name Rick Hastings, rom-coms under the name Scarlett Bailey. And my most recent incarnation is as Bella Ellis, writing historical detective novels.
I saw that, yes, as a pseudonym for a Bronte girl. My goodness, so yes. you literally yes. have a huge passion, don't you? And that Pondon Hall, that featured in Wuthering Heights, didn't it?
Well, many people believe that the interior for Pondon Hall is the inspiration for Wuthering Heights, and also Pondon Hall had the box bed, the famous box bed that you may know, that Kathy comes back to smash her hand through the window. They have now reconstructed the original box bed, but we know that there was the original one there. It was last seen in about 1945. And unfortunately, sometime after that, it got taken out.
Gosh, did you grow up in Yorkshire then?
I didn't, but I went to Bronte Parsonage Museum with my mum when I was about 10. I was really miserable about it. I didn't want to go. And she took me anyway, because, you know, mums. And I fell in love. I walked in the door. I just immediately, somehow, as a 10-year-old kid, I was particularly drawn to their juvenilia, their little tiny books that they made. And, you could understand them as a child. I could understand them as children, because it was something that I would like to do, to make tiny books. And that just sort of led me on this path that I'm still on.
Wow, how amazing. So it changed your life, really. I think there's something very magical about visiting authors' homes, these historical museums, and I've been to a few myself, and one day maybe you'll have one.
Probably won't, but it'd be nice.
lovely, isn't it wonderful, the world of being an author? Yes, it's dedicated, the book, to past, present and future residents of Pondon Hall, for the setting which draws you in as well. It's kind of spooky, and it's been described as hauntingly beautiful. Have you ever seen a ghost?
Unfortunately, I've never been haunted in Pondon Hall, not for the want of trying.
Did you say unfortunately? Where have you seen one? Not at home?
No, I suppose most recently in a hotel in Bath.
Really?
I was haunted. Just going into my room, I put my key in the door to go into my room, which was in the, what would have been the servants' quarters, I think. And suddenly, and completely sober, suddenly I heard two voices whispering almost in my ear. And I ran into the room and shut the door, and it stopped. And then I thought to myself, well, ghost. Doors probably don't make any difference. And then I wasn't afraid, and I went to sleep, and I woke up in the morning, and all the drawers in the big heavy oak chest of drawers had been opened.
No. And were you not frightened?
No.
And did you tell the hotel?
I don't know. I just think it's really fascinating.
Gosh, you're obviously really open to it with your writing and everything. That's really... But can you see them as well as hear them?
I don't think I've really ever seen one. I've felt one touch my shoulder, I think, and I've heard them. But I don't think I've really seen one properly.
Wow, there's an investigation to come from this. Oh my word. So that's incredible. So that'll send everyone running either towards or away from Pondon Hall.
So in Pondon Hall, the ghosts are mostly outside. You can stay there and not meet a ghost, I promise. I've been staying there for 3 years, sleeping in the box bedroom, and I've never met a ghost.
Gosh, really? So you really have immersed your research into the places. My word, I'm not coming with you to that one. I'm too scared. So I just want to share some of the opening paragraphs of your book, The Girl at the Window, because it's really beautiful the way the setting is described, and it really drew me in. If you wouldn't mind just reading the first chapter.
I inhale the landscape around me. Bathed in the last of the afternoon sun, it glows softly of coppers and golds, and it's just how I imagine it when I think of it, which is often, always different, always changing, always the same. Pondon Hall is a house built with light. It's a beacon, a lighthouse with no sight of the sea, pulsing in the dark, and sending messages far and wide for the special few that can hear them.
Thank you for that. That was really special. And I just thought, actually, it was nice to share that, because that really drew me in. And it's lovely to hear your voice reading that. So thank you for that. So you've described your life as juggling writing novels with raising 5 children, including twins. How do you plan your day? When do you write then?
Well, they're all at school, so that's good. But I have learned that I'm a real terrible faffer, so I do have after-school help, because I sort of hit my best creative time at exactly 3 o'clock, which is rather weird. And I usually then write till about 6:30. So I work from midday, but my best work gets done about 3 o'clock, and then I finish in time for bedtime.
And that's every day?
Monday to Thursday.
Monday to Thursday. Yes. I think it's important, isn't it, to have a structure. That's what writers say, you know.
Yes, it is important to sort of keep your head in the idea. I think if you have too long a break, you can fall out of the book, and you sort of lose the rhythm, and then you have to get yourself back into it. And that's almost as annoying as starting again in a way. So,
gosh, good for you. Now, you have a challenge with your writing, don't you? How do you cope with dyslexia?
I've kind of just got it down now in that I write a first draft without worrying about anything at all, just getting the story out, which is kind of like free fall. So I just put down all of the words that are in my head and onto the page, onto the screen. And then invariably I go back to it and it's a mess. So then it takes me probably as long again to make it readable. And then I have a couple of friends who copy edit for me, and then I deliver it to the publisher, who then copy edits it again and then proofs it twice.
Wow. And I mean,
the long process.
I mean, you have to be patient with yourself, don't you, in terms of, I mean, does it affect you in terms of reading? I mean, you just read that beautifully just now, which is why I was saying...
Yeah, it doesn't affect me as much in terms of reading now. It did when I was younger, but I pretty much, unless I'm tired or it's a very dense passage of prose, or it's a particular typeface, like a sans serif typeface is a bit harder for me. It's easier for some dyslexics. Then I might kind of lose it for a bit. But if I'm, you know, wide awake and I'm engaged and it's a good story, then I'm okay. In terms of writing, it's that's really where it affects me. But I think the thing is it's a double-edged sword, because dyslexic people do tend to be extremely creative, very visual, very good lateral thinkers, 360-degree thinkers. And so I think kind of dyslexia is what makes me pretty good at writing novels. So I put up with the annoyance.
Amazing. And the determination and patience pays off, which is incredible. And do the words jumble on the page, or the letters transpose, or...?
In the writing, it's weird. I don't really understand how it works. It can be just that my hands will type out a perfect word, but it's just not the right word. And so there's a disconnect between here and here, that just, the associations are just not what they should be. And I don't really know. I'm not an expert. I don't know why it happened. There are some words I just can't spell. And sometimes I just get too excited and it all just goes horribly wrong.
Wow. Or you may come up with a word that's even better. But I mean, would anything be able to help other people with dyslexia? Would you say write more, or?
I think there are so many strategies now that there weren't when I wasn't diagnosed till I was 20, but there are people who use colour acetate sheets, which really helps them with their writing. Often it is the serif, it's the font and the size of the font that helps with reading. I think for children particularly, there are some great publishers that are specifically aimed at children. And an author I know called Tanya Landman has just done a version of Jane Eyre specifically for dyslexic children, and it's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. So I think we all have to find our own way into how we cope with it. Yeah. But the most important thing is that you can cope with it. And to encourage dyslexic children and boys and particularly to realize it's not about being stupid, it's just a different way of your brain working. It's just having an atypical brain, really.
Thank you. That will help. That will help some people. So where do your stories and ideas come from? Do they just sort of suddenly come to you in your sleep, or?
Actually, they do sometimes suddenly come to me. The Pundon Hall book felt, The Girl at the Window feels a lot like, it felt like fate. I was really wanted to write something in sort of that in, was inspired by Wuthering Heights, but not Wuthering Heights. I didn't want to rewrite Wuthering Heights because that would be mad. And I was sort of thinking about it and wondering how I could approach it in a fresh way. And then I got invited onto a photography course held at Pondon Hall. And I, even though I'm not a photographer, I went because I knew that Pondon Hall was one of the inspirations for Wuthering Heights. And while I was there, I found out a little bit about the family of the Heatons that lived in Pondon Hall from the 1500s to 1898. And it was such a good story. And it's also potentially one of the inspirations for the plot of Wuthering Heights. So I went back to the original source material, the Heaton history, and developed a new idea out of that.
Brilliant. Yes. So it all came as...
Yeah, while I was there, I was working out how to... I wanted to sort of put Emily into the book because she... All of Bronte sisters went to Pondon Hall a lot. They used the library there. And it actually saved their lives one day when they were children, which is a long story. But if you want to find out about it, look up the Crow Hill Bog Burst. And so I was thinking, well, there's a literary mystery in The Girl at the Window. And I was thinking about putting the three Bronte sisters in, solving this literary mystery themselves. And then I thought, wait a minute, that's too good an idea. I'm going to keep that out and it can be its own separate book. And that is how the Bronte mystery novels were born, which basically imagines that before they were authors, they were amateur sleuths.
Oh gosh, so you're really, you should have been a Bronte sister. You're really so aware. You've written under a Bronte pseudonym, your pen name too, as you have a very obvious passion for the Bronte sisters. And that's recently come out too, hasn't it, Bella Ellis?
Yeah, that came out in November, yes.
The Vanished Bride. And how are they going, your books?
Yes, good, really good. Brilliantly well received, which is always a joy, because you worry about it very, very much. Particularly really worried about The Vanished Bride because it is a bit of, I think that some particularly strict Bronte people might be a little bit annoyed by the idea of playing with their legacy in this way. But in fact, it's been really well received by Bronte academics and general readers thus far. And that's really pleased me because I did put a lot of research into it and all of the biographical research and all the biographical stuff in the book is based on their real lives. It really happened. So I'm delighted to say that it's been pretty well received thus far.
Thus far, even thus far, is immersing yourself in the periodic history, and it's very topical at the moment, isn't it? Books and films on strong women of history. I mean, I saw Little Women at the cinema the other day. What do you think of that? It's incredibly powerful and emotive, isn't it? And
I haven't seen it yet, but all I've heard is really, really great reviews, and I think that's wonderful. It's lovely to see books and films that are, they're not writing the archetypal strong female character that, you know, for a while that you had to have as a sort of stereotype token woman. They're portraying women in all of their brilliance and frailty and strength and complexity and all the things that make us really fascinating human beings, and that's why women are an interesting subject for movies and for books.
And so often,
you know, a book written by women featuring women is considered to be less than, and that drives me nuts. So I really hope that this is the beginning of a phase where we are able to accept women producing movies and books about women as equal to books and movies about men by men in quality and importance.
Definitely. I mean, I thought it was incredibly powerful. I think, you know, there's some very good acting. It's very powerful, very emotive, and makes you cry a lot. And I think the way they've done it is brilliant. And with the setting backdrop of the American Civil War as well, it's, you know, as with your books, you know, to have a very strong backdrops and very strong historical themes actually does make a really strong concept, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So we've talked about your love of Yorkshire and Hertfordshire. One of your novels, The Memory Book, was chosen as a Richard and Judy Book Club selection in 2014. Was that for something specific about mementos being precious?
It came about, the origin story for The Memory Book, it came about from a trip to the supermarket, and I was standing in the queue behind a lady who looked rather lost. And she wasn't taking anything out of her trolley. And so I started to talk to her and I took her stuff out of her trolley and we just had a little chat. And she said, oh, my husband is here, but I don't always remember what he looks like. And so we talked and I put her things out, and then her husband came back and packed up and paid, and they were about to go, and he said to me, thank you for talking to my wife. She doesn't always remember who I am, but she always remembers that she loves me. And every time I say that, I get a little shiver. Mm. And off he went. Never saw him again. But from that line came the whole of The Memory Book. Wow. And it's a story of a woman with early onset Alzheimer's. And she's putting together a book of mementos and memories for her children and for herself to hold on to them as long as she possibly can.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's really lovely describing it like that. And I wonder what had inspired you, whether it was dementia or Alzheimer's or some sort of personal relevance like that, because it often comes from something. And isn't that a lovely story? And what a lovely husband by the sounds of it as well, isn't it?
Was a lovely, yes. I mean, I think Alzheimer's is a horribly savage disease, you know, and it rips families apart and it takes away the person that you love bit by bit. And there's no easy way to write that. Definitely. And to me, I was trying to focus on the courage and the love and the steadfastness of families that support somebody they love with Alzheimer's, as they basically just disappear in front of their eyes. It's really heartbreaking. And I do hope that in the near future we'll see a cure for it.
They're getting there, aren't they? It's not nice. Now, you won an award for Dearest Rose, a novel which led you down a different path, and you became an active supporter of domestic abuse charity Refuge, donating 100% of your royalties from that publication of the novella Woman Walks Into a Bar to their charity. Wow, what inspired that? Was that another?
I think that was mainly because I have a Facebook page for my readers, and it was a long time ago now, but I asked them what they would like me to write next. And one of them had read Woman Walks Into a Bar, which was originally a quick reads novel that I'd done a few years previously, and said, could you write a full-length novel on domestic abuse as a theme? And I thought that would be quite interesting. So I just asked on this thread if anybody wanted to share their stories with me in confidence, you know, to send me a direct message. And I didn't really think about it very much. Went away, came back next day, looked on, and there were over 200 messages in my inbox, and that was really very shocking to me, and a huge wake-up call actually, and as to how prevalent domestic abuse is in people's lives. Not, you know, there's no stereotype to the kind of person that is a victim of domestic abuse. They can be wealthy, well-educated, bright, strong women and all men, and then get trapped into this terrible, violent, coercive relationship. And once you're in, it's very difficult to get out. And I read all of those stories, and for a while became very overwhelmed by the idea of trying to do justice to these real people who had sort of trusted me. And so then I boiled it down into a fictional story, and after that came out and after it got the award, I sort of felt so grateful that I decided that I would do this. I'd repurpose my quick read into an ebook to support Refuge. And certainly in the beginning, it's sales now have dwindled off. It was several years ago, but it did pretty well in the beginning and raised a few £1,000. So that was great.
Gosh, that's fabulous that you did that, and terrifying, you know, that many people have, you know, no one to tell their story to. And that was a brilliant thing that you did. And in fact, we have had two podcasts that are still available for people to download in the past, or several podcasts, one that touched on PTSD, one that touched on abuse where somebody had triple abuse in their life, sadly, at school, at home, and with their husband, and an episode on narcissistic abuse with the top narcissistic abuse expert in the world from Australia I interviewed, and that has had nearly more hits than any other podcast. So it's just, it's really an awakening that the massive listenership we get and the terrifying epidemic it is and the people that we are helping and healing. So we thank you for that.
Yeah, it is there are two women every week who are murdered by their partner in this country, and that is shameful, and we should be more shocked about it than we are. And stuff is being done, but it's very, very slow, very slow.
A lot of your books are very emotive, heartwarming, uplifting, and have common themes about life, loss, motherhood, and helping heal others. One about twin sisters, maybe inspired by the twins in your own life, a runaway wife, hopefully that's not you, and beautiful illustration, very distinctive. So emotions and real life, is that very important to you?
I think it's important to me to make emotional connections with my readers, and to kind of, I think one of the magic about books is that it's a sort of time travel in a way, and you can put down an emotion, a feeling, a thought, an aspiration on the page, and then somebody else opens it and it transmits into their brain, and that's the sort of connection that I really enjoy seeking out and trying to make with my readers. Realism is important, but I also really enjoy magic, not in a sort of literal abracadabra way, but I think the world around us is full of magic, and we are as individuals full of magic in ways that we might never really know until we are tested. So quite often my books have a theme about an ordinary woman faced with an extraordinary circumstances, and the magic is often the strength and resilience that she finds within her.
Wow, and that'll help people as well, and similar, you know, to our podcast in terms of wanting to overcome adversity, smash stigmas, yeah, and change perceptions. And I think we're all doing that, which is fabulous. What would you say to others facing challenges they're battling to overcome and find it difficult to come back from, to seek their own magic?
Yes, I think so, actually. I think seek your own magic. And I don't think it matters what the magic is either, particularly. Sometimes it's legal. I have lived with anxiety, quite crippling anxiety, for the last 5 or 6 years. And I find several therapeutic ways to work with it, but also for me the best escape is a really great book or a really great movie. I just like to be outside of my own head for a little while, and that's basically how I do it. And I love to watch horror films, and when I'm really anxious I watch a really scary horror film, and that's one of the little secret magic tricks that I have that a lot of people are like, what? I'm like, yes, because it the adrenaline and the fear that you have anyway discharges when you,
because you feel your feelings, don't you? And that's what it's all about. It's actually feel your feelings and let it, and then it's sort of, yes, calm follows. Gosh, good for you. We'll all have to try that. So, yeah, I hate them. So, who have you met that was influential to you then? Sadly, not one of the Bronte sisters.
Who have I met who's influential to me? Gosh, lots of people. I think often the people that are really influential in my life, I have never met. The poet Maya Angelou was incredibly influential on me when I was a sort of early teenager. Couldn't be more different from, this powerful Black American woman to this kind of nerdy, plump teenager in Hertfordshire. But the poetry that she wrote really engaged with me when I was feeling particularly lonely and almost outcast, I suppose, and made me feel less alone. And that really influenced me and changed sort of the person that I am. In real life, I suppose my mum is probably the biggest influence on me. She's very, she picks herself up after getting divorced after 28 years of marriage, from being a stay-at-home mum to getting a job and keeping a roof over our heads. And she's raised me to be a very independent and determined person who always likes to have agency over their own fate. Slightly controlling.
Bless her, I like that. Agency over their own fate. And that is so true, isn't it? And changing our mindsets. So the proudest moment of your life so far?
My children, on the big scale of things, my children are my proudest moment.
Well, you've got five though, haven't you?
Yeah, four that I've personally given birth to and a stepson. And I'm very proud of them, very proud of all of them. Love them very much. In a career sense, what's my proudest moment? I mean, I think it's quite important to look at the big picture, particularly in a creative career, because it's not always, rarely is it always going to be Richard and Judy or Zoe Ball or Sunday Times Top 10. So I think I'm really proud that I've been a published author for 18 years and that I've always done my best to write the best book. I've never phoned it in. I've always given 100%, and I'm really proud of that.
Good for you, and your readers will appreciate that too. So what do you do when you're not working? You're watching horror movies and talking to ghosts?
Film. I love going to the cinema. I'm taking my two oldest to see Jojo Rabbit later today. And I love to paint. I find that another really good way to deal with the anxiety, actually, because it just takes your mind away from everything else and you can concentrate on the canvas in front of you. So I've been painting again for about 2 years, paint landscape, and it's quite gratifying to see improvement over those couple of years. So that's been quite an important part of my life as well. Walk my dogs. Sleep. Very big fan of sleeping.
And libraries, by the looks of it. You've got an entire library behind you. Is that all your books?
Yes. Well,
it's all very well organised as well.
Yeah, I collect Bronte books, so
wow,
most of them.
Oh, how beautiful. Gosh. Oh, sorry, we can't share that. I should have... You'd like to live every day as if you were starring in a musical, I've read. What's that about then? Are you a singer?
No. I am a singer. I'm an enthusiastic singer, but I'm not a very good one. That's funny. That's from a bio from quite a few years ago. And I do love musicals, and I just love the whole magical quality of the idea that you can be in a world where people suddenly decide to have a burst into song instead of have a conversation. Why not? I think that's brilliant. I think we should all do it in real life.
Definitely. They do with flash mobs. You need to join one of those choirs that flash mobs. Yes. I've done that myself. Yes. Before. They're fantastic.
And it always brings so much joy.
Exactly. It's big in America. Definitely. I've done it myself. It was one of the best things. So do you have a mantra for living your life then?
I think my mantra is always show up. So
that's a good one.
I always get down to, the keyboard. Keep showing up. I keep doing what you're doing and to the best of your ability. I think if you do that, if you do the best that you can in work and in life, then you'll be there when the stars align, when there's a little bit of luck comes your way, and the magic happens, you'll be ready because you'll have put the work in and you'll have done the best that you can as a person, as an author. And you'll be ready for when luck looks your way. And I do think actually there is always a little bit of that sparkle of magic you need to have that kind of real special success with a book or success in life, you know, buying a house. There's always a little bit of a sparkle of magic or fate that comes along as well.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you. So what's next for you then?
Next, I'm currently writing the second novel in the Bronte Mysteries series, which is brilliantly good fun. I'm immersed in a snowy December in 1845, really enjoying it. And then after that, I'll be starting work on the next Rowan Coleman novel, which is in development. I can't tell you any more than that.
Wow, so that's literally, what is that, 4 in a year then?
No.
How long will it take you to write these?
I usually write 2 novels a year, but this year it's 1.5, I think.
And then they'll be published?
The Bronte Mysteries will come out this year, and I imagine Rowan Coleman will come out next year, probably. Yeah.
Anything else influential that we want to add to send out to the world? And men love our podcast too. They want to know why women are influential. They hear our stories.
What I would say is to the men that are listening to your podcast is that anyone can be a feminist, including you. I'm a feminist. I'm married and I have 4 sons. I love guys. But the way, if I could influence the world anyway, it would be to get the good guys to be better allies to women, particularly online. As soon as you stick your head above the parapet on the internet, there are men ready there to tear you down. And I'd really like to see more vocal and visual allies in male community, if one can call it that, generally, to say, actually, you know, that's not what I believe. And I support more visual women in the world. I support them. I stand by them.
Yes. In fact, I'm on some communities online as well, and one of them was saying a thread recently that women are very good at tearing each other down when they should actually build each other up, and women need to get better at that too.
Yeah, and I think at the risk of sounding a bit scary, I do think that's a legacy of the patriarchy that we have been brought up in. We've been brought up to compete with one another, to tear each other ever down, and also to stop noticing or caring or appreciating women when they get to a certain age, as if they're suddenly no longer relevant. And the opposite is true for men. You know, men hit their 50s and they're in their prime and they're experienced and they're brilliant. And for women, it's so often the other way. And that's, for me, as somebody who's approaching 50, I mean, it's a year away, but still, I...
Well, there's that book, isn't there? There's that book. I know there's a book saying invisible women, you know, people worried about women becoming visible. So keep the magic, keep us visible, keep it happening for men and women is what we'd say, isn't it? Oh, thank you, Rowan. Thank you for your time. The Influential Women's Podcast talks to broadcasters, advocates, celebrities, authors and influential women who have smashed stigmas and overcome adversity in their lives or with their health. Hard-hitting topics have covered from grief to divorce, from abuse to narcissistic abuse, PTSD to epilepsy, fame to failure, mental toughness to confidence. And we meet women who inspire and uplift and motivate us, who may influence you to change your day or even your life. If anything in this program and show has affected you, please contact experts who may be able to help you. Co-founded and produced with host Nikki Bannerman and multi-award winning Juliet Nichols, please join our tribe on Facebook and become a patron on Patreon, P PATREON, or sponsor our shows in the build-up to our third birthday on International Women's Day in March, and email Nikki at nikkibannerman.co.uk or Juliet at Pineapple Audio Production. Smash stigmas and change your life, or help others.